Hey everybody, Ron Placone here. Do you want to become a member of the Indie Bohemians Morning Show? Well, now you can. Go to patreon.com/indiebohemians. That's patreon.com/indiebohemians and become a member today. A lot of cool perks out there. Perks include t-shirts, access to the archives, a Google Hangout with Paulina and myself to talk about the show, free admission to comedy shows when we come to your town, and even a private comedy show. That's right, a comedy show in your living room featuring all the players of the Indie Bohemians Morning Show. So please, patreon.com/indiebohemians. We are a completely independent operation. We are not under any corporate umbrella whatsoever. Become a member today. Again, that's patreon.com/indiebohemians. Good morning, everybody. Ron Placone here. It is Tuesday, and just like last Tuesday, we did another TYT roundtable featuring Young Turks Network partners myself, Jeff Waldorf, and Dan Sparin up in Canada. So without further ado, let's get straight to that. You are listening to the Indie Bohemians Morning Show.
I have with me today two of my favorite TYT Network hosts hanging out with me today. I've got Ron Placone, host of the Indie Bohemians Morning Show over out of Nashville, Tennessee. And, of course, we've got our Canadian TYT Network partner, Dan Sparin, here with us today. Hey, guys. What's up?
Howdy.
Good evening, fellow Americans.
Is it evening? Is it? I don't know. It all matters and when this gets replayed, I guess. But nonetheless, it's great to have you guys here.
Good to be here, man.
I can do alternate takes if you like.
The various salutations of Dan Sparin.
Yeah.
For your cell phone pleasure.
This replays. Okay, so this is a nightly replay. Good evening. Okay, now we'll do one for morning. Take two. Fun time.
You need some extra so people go to the website.
Oh, fun. All right. So we've got some fun stuff for you. Actually, probably not that fun, but we got some interesting stuff and some great discussion coming up for you here on the Round the Nation Roundtable. So let's start out, guys, with some polling. You guys like polling? You guys like polls?
It depends. I'm gonna say it depends on the time, the place, and who's filling out the prehistoric ballot.
I'm for anything GoDaddy sponsors. So,
fair enough.
Is it a GoDaddy poll?
Yeah, they do it right.
Or does it have less credibility?
Oh, and speaking of credibility, you can't get more credible than a Reuters Ipsos poll. And that's who took this poll. Now, this poll points out how Republicans think that, it kind of ranks people in who's a more imminent threat to the United States. A new Reuters Ipsos poll shows that Republicans think that Obama is one of the highest imminent dangers to the United States. This is fascinating. Now, according to this poll, taken from Reuters Ipsos, a third of Republicans believe that Barack Obama poses an imminent threat to the United States, more than Putin and more than Assad and even more than the Ayatollah. The Ayatollah. Barack Obama is a bigger, more imminent threat to the United States. So let me kind of break this down a little bit. Now, this poll, which was done online, asked about 3,000 Americans to rate how much of a threat a different list of countries, organizations, and individuals poses to the United States at a scale of, 1 to 5. 1 being no threat and 5 being an imminent threat. Now, the poll showed 34% of Republicans that ranked President Obama as an imminent threat ahead of Putin, which only got 25%, Assad, 23%, and this is already crazy. What do you guys think so far? And is this nuts?
Well, I think the pool itself is just kind of leading and kind of bizarre, where it's like, okay, how big a threat are these people? How big of a threat are these people? How big of a threat are these people? It's just like, I mean, well, what is it? Is this like conducted by Warris Pace, Inc.? I mean, it's just bizarre to me.
Everything about this is bizarre. You're right about that one.
Does this mean there's like a greater chance that Green Day's next album will be about Obama? I like that there's an imminent threat aspect to this, though. And we're talking this in the rundown, where I was saying to you guys, listen, here's the deal, that technically, if an imminent means, you know, sooner than later, I guess technically Obama has the head start on leaders who don't control your nation. I'm disappointed that Stephen Harper did not make that list, because we will get harder. Keystone. We will get Keystone through, damn it.
Well, speaking of Keystone, actually, climate change was on here. It's not going to be a surprise that Democrats actually are more concerned about climate change than Republicans. 33% of Democrats said global warming, imminent threat. Republicans, 27% of them said not a threat at all.
It was cold this winter.
It was cold. I could go out and get a snowball and throw it on the Senate chamber floor and disprove climate change.
I had a jacket until late March. Brr, not imminent.
Yet, if there was a poll that came out tomorrow that showed that Barack Obama was in severe, severe trouble, I'm sure the Democrats could definitely change their opinion on a dime. Because last fall, they thought that climate change was a bigger problem than ISIS. And then a month later, they began bombing. So, Democrats, always such, good to stick by their morals.
Yeah, such is the nature of polls as well.
Right.
It tends to be like, what's in the news? What's cable news hammering this week?
But it is scary. Like, listen, forget how shoddy this poll is. I do think that there is something to be said that you would just think that the president of your nation is putting you in imminent danger. By
no,
like, what?
No, not putting you in imminent danger. Being the danger.
Well, whatever you want to say, the idea that the leader of your nation is actually more harmful than, like, enemy leaders, if you will. Quote, unquote, enemy.
Right.
I mean, that is kind of startling. And that goes back to the partisan politics that we talk about so much, is the idea that we don't create just two different ideals with two different set parties with two different sets of goals or ideas. We create us versus them, like they're evil and will ruin the country narratives. And that's where I think you've seen some people check out of politics altogether, too. Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's why I was saying about this pool. It's like it's just like this bizarre fear-mongering. Like when I think about polls, I think about like someone taking a phone survey and stuff like that, and I just picture this like, so do you have a few minutes to talk about all the great threats to your well-being? It's like, well, I was going to go to the grocery store, but yes, let's talk about it.
What else am I doing on noon on a Tuesday?
Why not? Right? You know, the whole partisan polarization thing, they actually asked about that, too. They asked, what political party is also considered an imminent threat, right? 27% of Republicans see the Democratic Party as an imminent threat to the United States. That's amazing. And look, to be fair, on the Democratic side, 22% of Democrats deem Republicans to be an imminent threat, which, you know, I don't know. Have we gone crazy? Like, yes. Republicans suck. Don't get me wrong. Republicans suck. But an imminent threat to the United States? Not so much.
Yeah, well, I mean, why? It shouldn't just be Republicans or Democrats or this or that. It should be, like, actual issues, you know? Like, ask people about, do you think if this policy goes through, it would be an imminent threat? Keystone Pipeline, for instance. Would that be an imminent threat if that happens? Like, that's a better question to ask people.
Yeah.
Is Obama an imminent threat? I mean, how bizarre of a poll is this?
It just has to do with simple questions, I think. You know, you throw out some simple questions, you're going to get some simple answers. Guys, it's also going to show how ridiculous our politics has become at this point.
Listen, it's been a week since that Zane guy left One Direction. We have inches to fill, all right? It is hard running a newspaper.
Yeah, stop. There's a lot of space.
It's crazy. All right. You guys have anything else you want to add to this one or no?
I think I'm good on this one.
Yeah. I think it's relatively simple.
I stand by the fact that our Subway ads in Washington, D.C. will change your mind about Keystone.
All right, let's move on. There's some changes coming in the Senate. With Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid set to retire here at the end of his term, they need to pick a successor. Well, it turns out Harry Reid and Dick Durbin have decided to endorse Chuck Schumer as that successor to become leader of the minority leader of the Senate Democrats. Now, they endorsed him because he is, quote, next in line, according to, and this is, I believe this was in the Huffington Post, I believe. It looks like Schumer has things in the bag. Now, that's a little bit disastrous, in my opinion, because Chuck Schumer is incredibly close to the banks and is part of the basically business wing of the Democratic Party. But I want to get your guys' thoughts on this. I mean, what do you think of this whole Schumer being set up to be the next successor in line for Democratic leadership in the Senate? And, you know, like, what do you guys think?
Well, I guess, to go on your point, I think in a lot of ways he is what I would just characterize as a corporate Democrat, with his relationship with the banks and some of the stuff that we were talking about him, where he's at socially. I mean, it seems like he's kind of just this, corporate suit, maybe even like a dino to some extent. But I'm not really surprised that's the type of person they're looking for to fill that void. I mean, that's pretty typical.
Right. I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah. I think the other thing to think about is that you're in an election year. So they don't want to go, they're not going to bust out like Dennis Kucinich. You're just like, you're not just going to take somebody.
But why not?
From the far left and put him in the power.
But why not, though?
And also, listen, we all know what 2016 is, right? It's fundraising time, 2015. So, yeah, listen, Chuck Schumer was basically heading up the part of the party when they actually gained seats, and that man runs fundraising. Like, and that's the part of politics people don't see. That's how you ascend to the top. Can you raise money well? Chuck Schumer can. Chuck Schumer's in a position where, he's not going to spook the big donors, and the Democrats have to run an election in 2016. And, listen, we're all going to get placated by the Liz Warrens and of the left. But in the reality of the American political system, this is what the politics has come down to, which is who can raise the most money up until the election date. And so that's what's going to be, basically determining your politics. And that's what it has been determining the outcomes of elections in America for a long time. So I think that, once again, like we always talk about on this program, is the idea that until you can change the culture, Chuck Schumer's are always going to get those gigs.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you don't really find it ironic that this just comes right after news that a lot of big bank donors and lobbyists and stuff are threatening to cut off the Democratic Party from campaign contributions, or legalized bribes, as we like to call them here, because of the influence of Warren. And this is sort of like the Democratic Party saying, hey, big banks, don't worry about it, guys. We're still on your side.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was very strategic. And, I think to Dan's point, it's just like, yep, this is the system we have. And until we get money out of politics, this is the game that's going to be played.
Yeah. Sadly enough, I mean, this is sort of what we're stuck with. And, it would be nice to have a leader in the Senate somewhere, taking the reins of the party that isn't beholden to to big money or the big corporations, big banks, you know, who's actually standing up for progressive values, because that's what we'd love to see. But as we pretty much all know here, that's not, until we get money out of politics, that's just not what's going to happen.
Let me, as the outsider on this panel, though, push back a little as the Canadian looking inside your country, looking at your snow globe and going, huh, that's fun. The question I have for both of you, though, is we can blame, quote unquote, money in politics. But the people, like, do you think the average American cares? Because they don't come out and vote. And this is a system that, you know, the guy who has the best ad wins. So at what point are you ready to say, okay, you know what, the public's a little bit to blame here for the candidates and the quality of people that we put into politics?
Well, I mean, not to get into the average person's head or anything like that, but I think for people who are a little bit more in the know and decide, I don't want to be a part of the system, look at all the money. It's not like my vote matters. It's not like my vote, you know, is worth anything compared to all the money that's being thrown around or all the negative ads. Or there's a lot of negativity when it comes to the regular Joe when it comes to politics. I don't want to get involved in this. This is crap. And a lot of it is influenced by the money. I mean, what the money is used for, what? Advertising. Negative advertising for the most part. I mean, there are very few candidates out there that have actually run a non-negative campaign. As much
as
they try to run
them. Negative campaigns work, though. That's my point. Is negative campaigns keep working.
And that's where all the money goes into, and that's what turns people off.
Yeah, but does it?
I think you go out and ask a lot of people what they think about a lot of the campaign ads, and they're going to tell you, dude, this is crap.
But I think that there is definitely a wave of apathy going on. I mean, and that's indicated in lower voter turnout and stuff like that here in the States. But I do think a lot of it is people get disenfranchised because of decisions like this that are made all the time. I mean, and if we got more people in a position of leadership that were in those positions based on ideas that they had and policy ideas that they had versus their ability to pad pockets, I do think that would help turn that tide of apathy around a little bit, because I do think there are some kind of lights at the end of the tunnel, so to speak, that are indicating that people are paying a little bit more attention. People are noticing how a do-nothing Congress is really hurting the country and stuff like that. People are paying attention to that, and even that's even indicated in some polls that have been taken. So I think that, yes, the public is not blameless. They are certainly to blame. Mm-hmm. But are we at the point of apathy where there is no point of turning back? I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think that, you know, if you had some better ideas out there, I think more people would start paying attention, because I think a lot of people, it's not that they're not paying attention. They're just disenfranchised.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you made a great point, Ron. You got to give people something to vote for, right? You got to give some people a reason to get involved. When people see, I mean, and that was the whole 2008 Hope and Change thing, right, that a lot of people got swept up in, that sadly turned out to be mostly crap. We've had some good change here and there, right, but not near the level of hype that was expressed during the 2008 campaign. Didn't really live up to it, but you gave a lot of people something to vote for, right, Hope and Change, and people went out and voted. We don't have that as much.
But that goes back to the American election system in general, though, and not understanding your own system, which is the president can't really do a whole lot on his own. So you can promise whatever you want, but as Obama – and so that's what bothers me, with, like, going back to the electorate – is that idea of they don't know what they're, you know, really getting into, and then they get more cynical about a process that they weren't really understand in the first place. So this sort of becomes the dog chasing its tail a bit. But more importantly than just that is that I really don't know, and this is where I think progressives fail, and I think we need to do a lot more work between elections in the big issues and really put more money into the idea of changing people's perceptions of unions, of the minimum wage, of these things, which, you know, environment and those things, which, you know, we have seen a little bit improvement in the last decade from progressive politics, but still needs a long way to go, because I still think the average American, if whatever you want to call the average American, but I still think there are more people in the States who are closer to Chuck Schumer than there are to Liz Warren.
You're listening to the Indie Bohemians Morning Show on Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 FM and 103.7 FM.
I don't necessarily disagree with you, but I think that, you know, I mean, to your point about, you know, people not understanding the process and this and that, Obama's approval ratings have never been as low as Congress. He's never, I mean, it's always been, Congress has always been lower. And I think it's because people see that process in play. They've seen, you know, this do-nothing Congress that has been straight up vitriolic. And I think it has reached a point of crisis where maybe, you know, people that weren't paying attention before are finally starting to notice this stuff more so than maybe ever before. So, I think that, yeah, the populace, there's a lot of blame there. But, you know, and I guess I just think we're not completely hopeless, but maybe some of that's a little bit of wishful thinking too.
No, I'm also not completely cynical. I think you need to be able to motivate people. And I think to add on to what you were saying, Dan, about changing our priorities and or how we really kind of approach it, we need a ground game. We need to go local. I mean, politics really starts at the local level. You can't really make a whole lot of changes until you build a movement from the ground up. And that's something that us progressives aren't the best at. I mean, when it comes to in reaction to things, for example, the recent bill in Indiana, we've had a lot of pushback against that at the local level, right? Where people are organizing, they're signing petitions, etc. But they kind of fail to realize that, hey, if we hadn't put the Republicans or allowed the Republicans to get in place in the first place, we wouldn't have stuff like this being passed.
Well, and I think another thing, some of the issues that you brought up, Dan, you know, you brought up the environment, you brought up unions and stuff like that, and living wages. These are things that have been attacked and demonized pretty much since Reagan and have been a really big, scapegoat for a very, very long time now. And we're still kind of working our way out of that. You know, it was a trend that lasted for a very long time, and we're finally starting to address it. People are finally starting to wake up and think, gee, this is ridiculous that somebody works 40 hours a week at an honest job in the contemporary United States and they're not making enough money to survive. People are finally addressing that. And it had to reach a point where wage inequality has reached a level that I don't think anyone could have even guessed was possible. I mean, it's reached a complete crisis mode where the middle class, as far as I'm concerned, isn't even a thing in this country anymore. But finally, you know, people are starting to get out of that. So I think some of these demonized entities, that shift's going to start turning because it has to at this point.
Just progressive politics in America, though, like the grassroots organizers and those things need to stop letting those phrases, liberal become a dirty word, grassroots organizer become a dirty word,
Community organizer.
Become a dirty word. Right. All these things that, like, you've got to have these pushbacks because, before they're needed. And that, like, how many times do we see progressives constantly on a defense when they should have been on an offense 10 years ago? Gay marriage is a perfect example of that. How many progressive politicians and Democrats specifically, well, we could argue whether Democrats or progressives, but the Democratic Party, how many times do we see them hem and haw over gay rights? Even Obama, like, yes, everything turned out okay, but he didn't campaign on it the first time around. You know, it was this kind of like tongue-in-cheek, wink, wink. I'm with you, but I'm not really with you. I'll see what I can do. And it's that kind of dance. And I think they have to do that because in between elections, we've done a very bad job as progressives in, you know, in a lot of countries, not just America, in showing people that, as Ron said, all of these things going back through Reagan, like, let's be honest, in the States, going back to FDR and the pushback after the New Deal. Straight on through, right? The idea of this is all sucking on the government's teeth and what are we going to do with that? And that's something that I think that the leftist needs to push back on, because we need to get to these things before they become bills, before you need to sign signatures to be like, hey, why don't we not be homophobic in Indiana? Like, it needs to happen before these things happen, before climate change is legitimately drowning small islands. And like, and that's the hardest thing to say, because it's the hardest thing to do.
Well, kind of bringing it back full circle to, you know, the money, you got to remember too, Obama really kind of evolved on the gay issue, mostly because he had a lot of bundlers, at least officially on the gay issue. I'm pretty sure that before he was like either ambivalent or you know, was pro, but he couldn't come out in that way. Strange way of putting it, but
yeah, I was gonna say, was the pun intended there?
Yeah, or no? pun intended there. Coming out in the issue publicly, he had a lot of support from gay bundlers who you know fundraised for him and everything. And it comes back to the whole, you know, money in politics thing. You expect something back, and that's what they got. His evolution on gay marriage. It's sort of him saying, well, thanks for all the gay money. We appreciate it. So now I'm going to come out and be more, you know, proactive on gay marriage and be more supportive on it.
Well, I do think he's also reflecting popular opinion. You know, I mean, one thing to be optimistic about as a society, we've evolved a lot. Not necessarily we, like the three of us, but you know, as a general populace, the populace has evolved a lot when it comes to, you know, issues of gay rights, when it comes to, you know, even gender issues and stuff like that. There has been a lot of progress made compared to the early aughts and stuff like that, and especially compared to the Bush administration. And that's why I think one of the things that Dan mentioned a little bit earlier, the whole thing, liberal's a dirty word, community organizer's a dirty word. The progressives do need to be on the offense about that, because now is the time to be on the offense, because clearly popular opinion is shifting in our direction, but we need to say, yeah, this is what we're about. Not like, oh, this might be what we're about. It's not so bad, I swear. Like, no, right. Like, this is what we're about.
But just like how money can drive someone to be more supportive of gay marriage, for example, in the example of Barack Obama coming out in support of gay marriage, money can also be something that holds people back. And going back to the problem of Chuck Schumer, his ties to big money are going to prevent some of the progressive policies that we would help to, you know, try and combat income inequality, for example. Those are going to be held back. And when you put Democrats like that in leadership positions.
I agree with you there, too. I mean, I don't think as a thinker and as a, you know, in terms of what kind of policies he has stood behind, I'm not a very big fan either. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really surprised, you know, he would get a gig like that just right. because of the way this is.
Well, none of us are, I don't think. Dan, you want to wrap us up?
Does anybody realize that Chuck Schumer's related to Amy Schumer?
Fascinating.
I'm just saying, weird topic. Sorry, I mean, it's not all bad.
Wait, what is the relation again? I know we were talking about it a
bit. Her dad is Chuck Schumer's cousin.
All right.
So if we get like a State of the Union roast maybe or something, we'll be all set.
Nice.
Okay. Awesome. All right. So let's head to the next story. Guys, let's talk about O'Reilly. You want to go to the Falklands? Because that would be one place where O'Reilly actually never was. Fascinating. Okay. So we're going to talk about O'Reilly here. Now, Bill O'Reilly continues to insist that he was there during the Falklands War and that he was in great personal danger. And he had told the story to CBS and to many different places of how he rescued his cameraman. He rescued him from mortal danger during a quote-unquote war zone. Now, it's not a stretch to – it's no surprise, I should say, that his story turns out to be bullcrap. I can say crap, right?
Yes.
Okay. Awesome. I had to make sure I was FCC friendly. So we'll go back to some of O'Reilly's quotes on this. He said, I was in a situation one time in a war zone in Argentina in the Falklands where my photographer got run down and then hit his head and was bleeding from the ear on the concrete. And then the army was chasing us. I had to make a decision and I dragged him off. He's a war hero. You know, but at the same time, I was looking around to try and trying to do my job. But I figured I had to get this guy out of there because that was more important. So he is a O'Reilly says he is a hero that he dragged his photographer, his cameraman out away from the army and saved him while he was bleeding. Well, it turns out, like I said, that was crap because the cameraman that he supposedly saved has now come out and said, no, that didn't happen. Now, his cameraman was named Ignacio Medrano Carbo. And he says, yes, I was O'Reilly's cameraman that night. That's about the only true thing that he said. he was there. And he says, of course, I was not beaten at any time during my Buenos Aires assignment. I do not even recall Mr. O'Reilly being near me. So much for the rescue story. And he's not the only one refuting. Of course, a lot of people working at CBS who had worked with O'Reilly said, no, that didn't happen. He was lying. He wasn't being honest about what happened that night or the video. And this is just another one, just another guy coming out and saying, completely wrong. O'Reilly, full of crap.
You know, whenever stuff like this happens, you know, like even like the when Brian Williams was facing all of his heat and stuff like that, I envision like they're at the studios and there's this really pretty intern and it's like their first job and they're an intern and they're very young and impressionable. And I picture Bill O'Reilly being like, yeah, you know what? Being a journalist, that's totally what I am, journalist. No one would dispute that. That's what I do. And here's what I do. And it's not always glamorous, and sometimes it's hard. I rescued this guy once, and then he gets in this web of lies. And the intern's like, you got to talk about that on the air. The world needs to know this story. And he's like, oh, yeah, I should. And then he's thinking in his head, no one's going to hold me accountable. I'm going to try this. And that's how this happens. That's my theory. I'm not saying it's perfect, nor do I have any insider information, but I'm sickened by it. I feel good about it.
Certainly plausible.
I'm not sure that it's actually a real intern as much as it's like a Great Gazoo character that O'Reilly has in his head at all times.
It might be the cartoon that appears to him.
Right, exactly. Like, hello, dum-dums. Tell that story. And like, it's just that idea that like this – you know what I think that – if there's one poignant thing to say about this entire, like, ridiculous helm, you know the first thing I think of when I think about the guys helping these chairs, and this is what I think is the saddest part of it, is that does it even matter anymore? And that's what I think the saddest thing is like, the first thought I think in your head is like, yeah, of course O'Reilly lied. What does that have to do with anything? And that tells you how badly not just Fox, but just infotainment in general has completely damaged journalism as a source, and how that, like, you know, they always talk about Jon Stewart and the rise of comedy becoming a more trustworthy news source for young people. But it's because of stuff like this. I mean, the real sad truth about the O'Reilly, whether or not he lied, which he obviously did, which I think he got – when he saved that cameraman, did he win a Peabody Award for that or a Polk Award? Once again, O'Reilly lying from like 20 years ago when he thought he got a Peabody, got a Polk Award. O'Reilly lying constantly about his home upbringing of Levittown, all these different things that he talked about. The issue at the end of the day is I don't think it matters. And that's what's really sad. Like, does it matter in the grand scheme of journalism? Yes, but is that what these guys are going after? Like, the teleprompter reader of NBC and the right-wing blowhard of Fox News don't tell you the truth. I'm not right. Sure people are going there for truth anymore, and that says volumes.
Well, I think the biggest thing is, and I talked about this with the Brian Williams thing too, like people don't differentiate between, you know, just talking head commentating for the sake of ratings, which is what O'Reilly does, and actual investigative journalism. People don't differentiate between those two things, and they are two completely different things. They are apples and oranges. And as far as the people that are watching that stuff, I mean, I'm pretty convinced the people watching Fox News at this point, they're not looking for truth or anything else. They're watching it because they don't know that anything else is out there, because their average age is 71 years old.
That's a good point.
They talk so much, like on the left, it's so easy to slam the Fox News viewer. But I mean, I think that all sects of society want to hear their own visions bubbled back to them. I just don't think, and I think that's what that news is becoming. I mean, we see this in entertainment too, right? On the web, like superhero stuff does well. There's these niche things that will always have a certain amount of people that like vampires. And they're going to watch that. And I feel that's sort of the same way in news and politics. There's always going to be a sliver on the left. There's always going to be a sliver on the right that enjoys people barking at the moon and repeating back the clubhouse catchphrase. And I think that Fox News has sort of hit that ceiling. And I think news in general has hit that ceiling a bit. And you're starting to see the fractured elements start to freak out. And the fact that television doesn't have that same captive audience that it once did, and like we're not sure even if people have just like passed out in comas and left Fox News on, and that's how Nielsen's getting the ratings. So I mean, these are the things that I think that all news media is seeing over and having problems with. But I think the big change for our generation is like, I mean, the first cable news memory I have is the O.J. Simpson Bronco chase. You know what I mean? Like that's an entire generation. I'm 31, so there has like journalism hasn't been in a state of trust in a long time. And I think that that's what I think maybe more than anything echoes sort of the sadness that I have about media, is that the answer to these questions is, does it even matter?
Mm-hmm. No, you bring up a good point.
Yeah, it's kind of a reflection, though, of how sad our media is today. And it's funny when you compare the O'Reilly, Brian Williams thing. Brian Williams got, you know, just, I mean, rightly so, he got punished for it, for being, you know, dishonest, right? For telling us a tall tale. What do you think is going to happen to O'Reilly? Nada.
Well, and I think part of that is a reflection of just, I think the general populace has evolved to the point where they see Fox News as what it is. It is a parody of itself. It is not a news network. It is an agenda-driven propaganda machine.
I think you're entirely too optimistic.
I don't know about that. I mean, 3 or 4 years ago, I would have felt that way. These days, I don't think so. I mean, in a lot of the statistics out there, kind of point to that. A lot of the statistics indicate that people are incredibly distrusting of cable news networks. Fox News is kind of just a running punchline that anyone from The Daily Show to SNL can utilize. And again, average viewership, 71 years old. Do they still have their base? Of course. But it's dwindling a lot, and I don't think it's really seen as a news network anymore, generally speaking.
Though, didn't a Pew poll like a couple of months ago show them as one of the most trusted sources of news?
Maybe.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
I'm not totally with you on that. I think that the thing is, though, from a – what I was saying by is it relevant isn't so much about whether or not we should hold these guys accountable, which we should, but more the idea of the average Fox viewer doesn't care because they want their own viewpoint, you know, spewed back to them, and they'll only see – O'Reilly getting fired as the left-wing media ganged up and got him fired. And just like so many on the left stood up for Brian Williams, which I thought was kind of shameful because he lied. And like, there's no excuse for it. And their jobs are different. Now, whether or not we think that the prompter, the guy who reads the prompter on NBC is a real journalist is a whole other conversation for another day. But at the end of the day, I think when you look at these two guys, I think the two interesting questions are is, what is the public's view of their role in media? And is it one of trust? Like, is it one where did anyone really care that Brian Williams told that story? And that's, I think, like, says a lot about where journalism is going. And especially with Brian Williams, the idea is like, I think moving forward beyond just the Bill O'Reilly tall tales idea is when journalism becomes entertainment, that role changes, and the skill sets that go along with that role are completely different Swiss Army knives. And Brian Williams, in a modern news anchor now, is expected to be on Periscope and is expected to be on Snapchat and is expected to be on the Jimmy Fallon doing the comedy bit and the Daily Show and keeping up with Jon Stewart. And when you make that the role, when you make him almost as a brand mascot, it's really going to be hard for these guys. Like, you know, forget Bill O'Reilly and the blowhard, but just take that modern role in the social media era where we want you to be a celebrity. And how isn't ego going to be attached to those? Like, that is, like, if you, anyone who has friends who are actors or comedians knows that we BS a lot.
You're listening to the Indie Bohemians Morning Show on Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 FM and 103.7 FM.
People be like, oh man, I did this show last week, and maybe you were on like fifth on the bill, and then like two shows later or that same week, like, you know, insert like Craig Ferguson was on the bill. You're like, oh, I did this place where Craig Ferguson was on the bill. I think people and comedians and actors are constantly sort of fabricating stuff. And so I'm not surprised that when you ask celebrities to become newscasters, when that becomes part of the goal, that you're going to have more and more of these problems of so-and-so kind of amped up their little war story because they're not journalists. They're personalities.
Well, the sad thing is, though, to kind of wrap this up, is that some people are having a difficult time trying to tell the difference at this point. At what point do our journalists become celebrities, and do our celebrities become quote-unquote journalists? You know, I see a continual blurring of the line in our infotainment, clickbait-type media that we have nowadays.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is. And because it's driven by ratings, and it's driven by stuff like that.
Advertising and, money.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it is a reflection of that big problem. I mean, all the things we've mentioned, I think, are kind of secular symptoms that go into stuff like this occurring, you know, between not holding, you know, powers to be accountable, not holding journalists accountable, not even knowing what journalism is anymore, blurring the lines between advertising and journalism, between entertainment and journalism. Mm-hmm. It's definitely all connected. But I do think the public is fleeing from Fox News. I really do. I'm sure there's some polls that would dispute that, and I'm not saying the base isn't still there, but I do think that's happening. Get on the optimism train with me, guys. Come on.
Well, hop on. I will agree with that. Not only are they more people not watching Fox News, but more people are abandoning cable news, corporate media for independent outlets such as ours and the Young Turks and our different channels respectively on the network. So there is good news. There is good news. All right. Moving on. We're about like 40 minutes in, by the way, and I forgot to reintroduce everybody. So that's my bad. You're listening to the TYT Network Roundtable here on either the Indie Bohemians Morning Show replay or FYI Nation, fyination.com/listen live. You can catch us on both of those networks at your different times. I guess you can look them up for clarity on when these will be replayed. I am Jeff Waldorf, your host. With me is Ron Placone, host of the Indie Bohemians Morning Show, and of course Dan Spearin, host of Truth Mashup, both on the TYT Network. And, of course, I am also on the TYT Network. So let's get going with Indiana, man. Indiana. Now, Indiana just recently passed their Religious Freedom Restoration Act type of bill. And Governor Mike Pence, of course, comes out to defend it recently. And this would be on ABC's This Week. Now, He describes the media coverage of this as just a bunch of shameless rhetoric. No, it won't discriminate against people. What are you talking about? It's just for Hoosiers to get back their so-called religious freedom, which somehow they feel is disappeared, which is complete crap, at least according to my opinion here. And he also says, we're not going to change this law. We're not going to do anything. We're not going to roll it back. We're not going to change it. We're going to make discrimination the law of the land. Essentially, if the General Assembly in Indiana, however, sends me a bill that adds a section that reiterates and amplifies and clarifies what the law really is and what it has been for the last 20 years, well, then I guess I'm open to that. Which is strange, because this is different than the other Religious Freedom Restoration Act. This actually adds provisions to where it's between businesses and individuals instead of just the government and individuals. This actually has this broadens it so that discrimination can be invoked to kind of protect people's religious freedom, so they say. What do you think about this so far and this whole thing?
Well, I mean, it's been really rough for me to see unfold, and I've talked about this a lot on my show, both on the radio and on my YouTube channel. And, you know, some of it's a little bit personal because I attended Indiana University. So, you know, the Hoosier State holds a special place in my heart. So I have not enjoyed seeing this go down there. And I've also not enjoyed, I want people to let the LGBT community in Indiana know that they're not alone, and let the people in Indiana who this does not reflect them, let them know that they're not alone, because there's a lot of people in Indiana that are upset about this. The protests have had thousands and thousands of people turn out that saying, you know, this does not speak for us. This does not speak for where we live, and we don't want this in our community. And Governor Pence, whenever he's questioned directly about, well, so is it okay for people to just turn away people from their business based on their sexual orientation? He can't give a straight answer to that. He won't answer that question straight. And that's because this is just about being able to openly discriminate. This is just about trying to make members of your community, in this case, LGBT members of your community, out to be second-class citizens. And it's sponsored by a lot of very homophobic people that, I mean, one of the sponsors of that bill is one of the people that helped push that forward is one of the guys that works with those correctional camps and stuff like that. So you have some very fringe, homophobic pockets, so to speak, behind this bill. So that's what this bill is about. I mean, the quote unquote religious liberty, I mean, those are just buzzwords that have no meaning whatsoever.
Of course, I don't see any part where anyone's religious freedom has been violated by allowing someone else of the same sex to get married to each other. It's ridiculous on its face. It's really, and I've called it this before, this law is a solution looking for a problem. And this is what it's always been. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, one of the things that kind of gets me, and in a lot of this, a lot of the kind of homophobic narratives are linked to some version of Christianity, right? And here's the thing. Still, to this day, about 77% of Americans identify with some form of Christianity. When you have, like, that much of a majority, you can't complain about not having some kind of liberty or this or that. You have the power, like you have what you want. You can go, you can practice whatever faith you want. You go to an institution that doesn't pay a dime in taxes. I don't know what these people are complaining about. It's nonsense.
Oh, well, they're complaining about not being able to control other people with their beliefs.
Right. Yeah, right.
That's essentially what it comes down to. I don't agree with the way that you live your life. So I'm going to, using my book as justification, tell you what you can and can't do with your life. I thought people like Governor Pence were against big government.
Right, yeah, like, except when it kind of fits his agenda or the people that are, you know, padding his pockets, their of agenda. Because I think in some ways he's a blank suit in a lot of ways, especially considering he can't defend this bill.
Well, how can you? How can anyone defend it?
Well, I mean, if he truly believed in it, he'd be able to at least, you know, throw some word salad out there. But he had able to do that. I mean, all he can do is just spit the buzzwords back out, because I think in a lot of ways he's just a blank suit. I could be wrong, but, you know, that's the way it appears.
Dan, why don't you go ahead and jump in?
I think the angle you're all forgetting is how this affects the rest of the world's bigots. And it really hurts up here, because every time you guys do something nuts down there, it gives our bigots hope. You guys are like an inspirational poster for bigots. It's like those motivational ones people send around. It's like, oh, look, somebody's riding a horse. This is what this Indiana bill is. So now people in crazy Canada who are like sitting in the backwoods up in Alberta going like, oh, man, if we only had some sort of hope that somebody would put a bill out, wouldn't let gay people have rights. Oh, thanks, Indiana. And then they're like, oh, perhaps our craziness can catch on here. And it's so painful. We really have done a good job in Canada of shutting our bigots up. And then every once in a while, this stuff happens, and it gives them new hope. So I'm just saying, Indiana, thanks a lot, because now there'll be some fringe group in Canada that's going to be like, look at this amazing bill from Indiana. It's going to take away our religious freedom.
And well, so, like, you know what, Dan?
Yes, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you don't have it so bad because here, all right, I live in a red state. I live in the state of Tennessee, all right? So whenever I see something like this, our first thought is, oh, man, they're going to try to do that here next. That's our first thought. They're going to be like I think our governor in Tennessee just has this bat phone type device, and, like, it just rings occasionally, and he picks it up, and he's like, somebody is trying to outbigot us. And he's like, well, I'm on it right away. And then they call the Koch brothers up. And then, like, Tennessee is like a five-year-old that's really prone to make bad decisions. So then when other five-year-olds make bad decisions, it's like, oh, Indiana just put a firecracker up a cat's butt and lit the match. It's like, oh, Tennessee's going to try that. And Tennessee, Uncle Coke supervises Tennessee and gives them all the money he wants. He's a spoiled brat. What are we going to do? So at least you just have bigots talking, all right? We might see some horrible policy.
It's really weird, like, to watch these things take root as, like, we watched, like, the death rattle of homophobia in you know, legislation, at least, and you start to see, like, the last grasp of old folks and just, you know, zealot Christians take over, and they're trying to throw everything in the kitchen sink at the reality, which is gay folks are finally getting rights. LGBT community is finally going to get the rights they should have been given long ago. And as, you know, Chris Rockland famously said about racism, white people are getting less crazy. And that's just what happens over time. And so I think that, you know, what I think is really frustrating with this is I was raised Christian. I was somebody who went to Christian school. Now I'm a born-again atheist. And one of the reasons is stuff like this, which is I never understood the part of Christianity that wanted to change law. And that always bugged me because, I don't think you're going to get up to heaven and have God be like, well, you got like 89 points out of the possible 100, but you were docked for that. I see you were a photographer at a gay wedding. Sorry. Like, that is just the thing. I don't understand the thought process. I don't understand why they feel the need to put it in the law, why they can't just love thy neighbor. And so many Christians are, you know, of that camp and don't agree with these kinds of things. But there's nothing in the Bible that's like, well, if you just look hard enough, it actually says coupon not redeemable if you are into, you know, homosexual sex acts. Like, there's just not a reason for these businesses to have any really gripe. And I think to go back to what Jeff said off the top, which is just like, this is completely the Bigot Protection Act. It has nothing to do with religion. It doesn't even make sense within the framework of Christianity, which a lot of us grew up in. It is a very small section of belief of Christianity that people think that things should go this far. And once again, America did a pretty good job in its foundation to try to stop these kinds of things from happening. So, I mean, the government, church and state, all of that sort of stuff, is these are those bills that are just horrendous. But I think there is a silver lining in how many corporations, different states, like Connecticut came out today and said there's going to be no state-funded travel. You know, Apple, like, not small things. Like, Apple's like the GM of, you know, Google and Apple are basically the biggest you get in the states. And they've both, you know, come out against this. So I think that you're going to see everyone's kind of just looking at Indiana and rolling their eyes, which I think is the only silver lining we can find here, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can agree with that. I think what heartens me is all the pushback that we've seen from, you know, all different sorts of people and even groups and corporations and stuff pushing back. Because, you know, most of corporate America is kind of on board by saying, you know, most people are in favor of this. maybe we shouldn't get involved in this whole religious thing or discrimination thing, especially since gay money spends just as good as straight money.
Yeah, yeah. They're just sitting in a board going, you know what? The money's still green, and we're not making chicken sandwiches, so let's just not judge people.
Yeah, and there's very few corporations out there. You know, there's Hobby Lobby and Chick-fil-A. That's pretty much the only corporations that are standing against, and they're actually working against their own economic interests as well, which is kind of funny, but by saying that we're cool with discrimination.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can, you know what? I used to enjoy Chick-fil-A. I stopped eating there a long time ago, even before a lot of that kind of stuff came to like the surface on the mass level, because there was other stuff that surfaced prior to that that indicated, yeah, this is a really homophobic organization. Mm-hmm. But and you can go on YouTube and you can make your own Chick-fil-A chicken sandwiches. So
there you go.
Just a quick public public announcement. Not to get off topic.
Okay. I think it kind of wraps it up. We got a couple minutes left for just a final quick story. Dan, you want to tell us what's going on with The Daily Show?
Well, after months of anticipation of who will take over Jon Stewart's hallowed seat at The Daily Show in New York, it turns out they're keeping it in the family. Trevor Noah, 31-year-old South African comedian, who will now take over John's chair. And everyone's kind of surprised. Not a lot of people know who he is. For those outside of the States, he's done a lot of comedy stand-up sets, different places. If you're really curious, I think one of the best sets was something he did up here in Montreal in Canada, Just for Laughs. He actually did a Mark Maron's podcast where he talked about his life growing up in apartheid. So he comes from a mixed marriage background, as he calls it. His mother is white. His mother is black. His father is white. And he has some interesting stories from that. He speaks several languages, and many people are thinking that part of the reason why The Daily Show liked him is he had this unique perspective. He was somebody who was quite intelligent and gave that worldly view. And I think we could all agree, watching The Daily Show over the last decade, sometimes The Daily Show is somewhat critical of America. So the question I have for you guys is, James Corden, Craig Ferguson, now Trevor Noah, I'm just curious, is my Canadian accent enough to get a talk show in the States?
We'll work on it.
Are you surprised, panel? Are we surprised by going with the unknown despite the fact his credentials are there? What do you think about the new selection that will take the helm and lead The Daily Show into the 2016 election?
I was a little bit happy that they didn't go with somebody super famous. When I was in Los Angeles and I talked to a couple people, that worked in production, and the kind of word on the street or whatever was that they were going to go with somebody really famous, and they were going to kind of make the show more like kind of just a weekend update or something like that, and less, you know, having a kind of political edge. And, you know, I kind of didn't like that. You know, I didn't like that idea. I kind of –